Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Your Honor, what I'd like to talk about is the first issue in my brief, which is the fundamental deprivation of Mr. Fuller's Sixth Amendment right to present evidence in his favor. The deprival of Mr. Fuller of the use of his expert witness, Dr. Michael Murphy, to put into context his mental illness, and we are talking about a person who's profoundly mentally ill, basically left the case in a vacuum. Under the statute under which Mr. Fuller charged, a jury has to decide if the statements made, the literal statements made, in the context with which they are made, constitute a quote-unquote true threat. And of course, there's a lot of debate going on as to what standard should apply, whether it's an objective standard or a subjective standard. And in fairness to both sides, there is no model instruction on the statute. But be that as it may, those aren't the central issues, I think, that I want to address today. The real issue is whatever standard is in play, the jury still has to be able to put the statement in context. Without understanding things like obsessive compulsive disorder, manic depression, and most of all, this concept of institutionalization, where we have a man who does everything he can to stay in prison, the jury has no way of putting the letter that formed the basis of this charge into any kind of context. And Your Honor, the cases cited in my brief stand for the proposition that evidence that might even at first glance not be particularly relevant, such as in the Hoffman case where the government put on evidence of the defendant's religious affiliation over the defense objection, the court says, well, the jury's got to understand how these things came to be. And if putting in front of the jury the fact that the defendant was a follower of the Reverend Sun Myung Moon somehow can aid them in deciding whether or not in the context in which these statements are made they constitute a true threat, then they have to come in. Well, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And without the jury being able to understand something about the lifelong nature of Mr. Fuller's mental illness, he has no defense. And we are talking about a fundamental right. We're not talking about something where we're trying to interpret a statute or decide whether or not somebody should have got money. This is a fundamental constitutional principle that a man, before he can be convicted, has the right to put evidence in his favor before the jury. Depriving Mr. Fuller of that essentially gutted his entire defense. The nature of a mentally ill person being incarcerated for life on the installment plan is really what's underlying this. This is the fourth time that Mr. Fuller, on the verge of being released, has written a letter to the Secret Service or the FBI and said, I'm about to get out. You better come get me. I'm going to do it. If you let me out, I'm going to go kill the president. So it's not just the word, no matter how frightening they may be, that we look at in isolation. One of the reasons I brought my son with me today, aside from the fact that he told me he doesn't understand what his dad does for a living, and the fact that he's never seen a Major League Baseball game, and I think every father should do that by the time a child reaches his ninth birthday, is to illustrate demonstrably the fact that, let's say the Secret Service got a letter, because the agents are saying, well, we take all these threats seriously. And it said, George Bush, you stink. I'm going to rip your head off. I hate you. Signed, Aaron Shima. Well, objectively, constitutes a threat. Literally, it's a threat. And the test isn't whether the Secret Service takes it seriously. The test is whether, assuming that we are going to stay with the objective standard, an objectively reasonable person, when understanding all of the circumstances and placed in the proper context, would be justified in taking the threat seriously. And there's just something fundamentally not right about a guy who doesn't want to get out of prison, is known to be mentally ill, is in the middle of his therapy, and then gets indicted for writing this letter that's designed to keep him in prison. I mean, when the agent said, we think this guy's just trying to stay in prison. That's why he keeps doing this. And I don't think I'm letting the cat out of the bag. It was predicted in my argument that if we don't get this guy the treatment he needs, if we don't get him back into the Access 2 program out there in Missouri, he's going to continue to do this. This is what obsessive, compulsive, manic, depressive type people who are institutionalized do. Long before I came into Mr. Fuller's life, long before Judge McKinney came into Mr. Fuller's life, a federal judge looked at him and said, you're an institutionalized person. You're comfortable in prison. There's a problem here. You need to be getting some kind of help. So, strangely enough, we have a situation where the government is basically doing Charles Fuller's bidding. You know, throw me into the briar patch. They continue to say, okay, you're a criminal, go back, do another 5 years, or just get onto it and say you're there for life. It never never addressed the underlying problem. To me, is something that it's hard to put in the context and the proper frame of a specific legal argument, but it permeates through this case. And to not even let a jury hear what Mr. Fuller's underlying illness is, I don't know of anything that could have more eviscerated his right to try his case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. My name is Joe Vaughn. I am here on behalf of Gail Hellert, who was the Assistant United States Attorney who prosecuted Mr. Fuller in the district court. That's correct. Thank you, Your Honor. The issue in this case really boils down to the references in the definition of a true threat of what constitutes a context and circumstances. Mr. Fuller claims that the excluded psychiatric testimony would have established both the context and the circumstances under which the statement was made. The government's position is that the district court's exclusion of that testimony was not an abuse of its discretion. Basically, Mr. Fuller sought to introduce the psychiatric testimony for two purposes. One, to show that the threat was made in order to stay in jail, and number two, that he never intended to carry out the threat, that he lacked subjective intent. In the court's supplemental filing, the Fourth Circuit in Lockhart has now backed off the earlier decision in Petillo and said that subjective intent to carry out the threat is not an element. That's only one way that the government can show that the threat was made knowingly and willfully. Mr. Fuller relies a lot on the Hoffman decision, which Judge Coffey authored. And in that case, there was a threat on the president where the government sought to introduce evidence showing that the defendant was a follower or a believer or had some sympathy to the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, and that evidence was relevant to show that Mr. Hoffman intended the letter to be perceived as a threat. So that evidence came in to show that Mr. Hoffman intended the letter to be perceived as a threat. Well, did Mr. Fuller intend for the letter in this case to be perceived as a threat? And I think that speaks for itself, because otherwise he wouldn't be able to stay in jail. He obviously intended it to be perceived as a threat. And in fact, Mr. Fuller admitted that in his plea colloquy on pages 12 and 13 and 23. The psychiatric testimony did not refute that Mr. Fuller had that intent, and that the court properly excluded the psychiatric testimony under rules 401 through 403 because, number one, it was confusing. And basically, as I understand it, it would have to be presented that Mr. Fuller, I intended for the letter to be a real threat because I never intended to carry it out because I wanted to stay in jail. I think that kind of testimony would properly be admitted as being too confusing to the jury. It also focuses or tends to carry over or spill over into the defendant's subjective intent of whether he intended to carry it out. something which is not an element, and I think that's not open to question now. The criteria is the objective standard, what a reasonable person would have perceived it to be. And finally, the intent to carry it out is not an element. Mr. Fuller also claims that that testimony also would have shown how a reasonable person would have perceived the threat. I would submit, first of all, that the reasonableness of the recipient's belief does not appear to be an element of the offense of threatening the president in violation of Title 18 United States Code, Section 871. It is, however, an element of the crime of threatening communications to other persons in violation of Title 18 United States Code, Section 876. In the event that this court was to feel the belief of the recipient is an element, Mr. Fuller was not deprived, or was not going to be deprived, of his ability to present evidence challenging the perceptions of the recipient. In the evidentiary hearing on September 2nd of 2003, Judge McKinney indicated Mr. Fuller could present that kind of testimony in his cross-examination of the government agents who had access to Mr. Fuller's prison files, which are the same files that that the doctor had access to in reaching his opinion. The cross-examination of the agent, however, would avoid the spillover problem with the psychiatric testimony that, and by the way, Mr. Fuller never intended to carry out the threat. He simply wanted to stay in jail. Finally, regarding the context and the circumstances, I think a question comes down to how far does that inquiry go? Is the inquiry one of, well, let's take a look at who received the letter, how it was received, what kind of words were used, and what was the form of the communication? Or is there some kind of a requirement that in order to evaluate the threat, you must go back and conduct some kind of a psychological or a psychiatric background investigation of the person who made that threat? I think that's very problematic to do that. Number one, it's simply not practical. If you required that, you could have situations where a threat could be made, and by the time that that kind of a background investigation is conducted, the threat's already been carried out. Number two is it also kind of makes you look at who the recipient is. What kind of resources does the recipient have, which you start to take an individual look at the various types of recipients, which moves away from that objective criteria of the reasonable person. I don't have any other comments for the court. If there are no questions, the government would stand on its brief and ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Your Honor, for what it's worth, I dispute whether the Fourth Circuit has backed off from Patello in the recently issued opinion. I think what they're saying in the case cited by Mr. Vaughn is to the extent that subjective intent is still a requirement that the government must prove. What they said is that it's not necessarily show that it was the defendant's personal subjective intent if she intended to convince other people to carry out the threat. And in fact, they cite with Patello with favor. Now, that's not the law in this circuit, but I have to preserve the issue because depending on what happens here, I may be arguing that issue another day. But that's not my strong suit, so to speak. What we have here is a situation where the judge says, well, this might all confuse the jury. Well, that's what trials are. You know, if juries get confused, and I've read thousands of opinions where this and other courts have said, look, you know, the judge, when he heard the evidence or she heard the evidence, he limited certain amounts of the testimony. There were less restrictive alternatives available. We could have had limiting instruction once the testimony came in. And the whole issue of whether or not the intent of the speaker is going to confuse the jury. I mean, we're talking about what this court said in Hoffman. We examine whether the statement was made in a context or under such circumstances wherein a reasonable person would foresee that the statement would be interpreted by those to whom the maker communicates a statement as a serious expression of intention to inflict bodily harm. So let's go back to my analogy about young Aaron Shima. Suppose he really intended to convey a threat when he sends his letter to President Bush. Is an 8-year-old is able to do it nowadays? Does that make him guilty of the crime? If nobody looking at it says, well, this isn't really a threat, this is just something that an 8-year-old has done. I think under Hoffman and under all of the cases, no matter which variation of the theme you're using to decide what the true test is, we would agree that if a jury looks at this and they say, well, look at the circumstances under which it's made. Look who made it, look why it was made, look what the intent was, and this isn't the stuff of an 871 conviction. That's got to be the law. So to say, well, it might confuse a jury, first of all, we're talking about a fundamental constitutional right. And under Rule 704A, Dr. Murphy's not talking about an element of the offense, so he can issue an opinion, for what it's worth, on the subject matter at hand. The government's certainly free to bring in its own experts and say, Dr. Murphy's wrong. Disregard Dr. Murphy, doesn't know what he's talking about. So with that, Your Honor, unless the court has any questions, I stand on my brief.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for the opportunity to bring him here.